So I'm excited because there's a lot of new work in this area on the origin of the Earth and the Moon. And as you probably know, today is the anniversary of the Apollo 16 launch 49 years ago. And I like it being on a Monday because it sort of puts my work week in perspective. They had 3-day commute with a nice view, landed, took a nap, got out, collected 47 pounds of moon rocks and came, you know, and launched again at the end of the week. So who remembers the moon landings? I mean, some in the room, right, as an impact. And I was born 3 months after the last moon landing, so I myself do not remember them. But the rocks we collected from the moon basically proved that all of the ideas for making the moon at the time were wrong, right? So this was a big shift 49 years ago. And by the end of the Apollo mission, Viktor Safronov had developed a model for forming the planets in a disk around the sun and prevented the first computer statistical calculations of planet growth, where he showed that towards the end of making rocky planets, large bodies would collide with each other. And given the fertile field of lunar science at the time, two different groups quickly picked up on this idea and proposed variations of the giant impact hypothesis for the origin of the moon. And the details of that model are in great flux today. But one thing that is common to all of the giant impact models is what the Earth looked like afterwards. So today I'll focus on the Earth, partly because of all the geoscientists in my group, so I can say a few things that are pertinent to their work, but also to introduce the rest of the audience to the Earth in a state that's quite different from what we know today. Okay. I'll begin with textbook cartoons for everyone, right? There is the proto-Earth, a differentiated body hit by another body. And this is a big event because they're planets. There's a lot, I'll get to numbers in a minute. And so we know that there's some input of energy, and that leads to a melted body with a core. Right? And given that things happen when rocks melt over a little bit of time, this melted body will have an atmosphere. Oh, I've lost my chalk. I'm going to call it blue. Okay, the atmosphere has a certain composition, and the jargon that we use is that it's volatile. What is a volatile? There's some audience participation. What is a volatile? What does that mean?
Evaporating.
Evaporating, stuff that wants to evaporate. How do we know when something wants to evaporate? Can you define a volatile? Phase transitions. Excellent. So in terms of the most abundant phases that we are talking about, water and carbon dioxide end up being the mass. This will go up. So everyone who's straining to see the bottom, this board will go up in a minute. Volatiles, water and carbon dioxide. And so given that people have already prompted phase diagrams, in terms of PT space, I'm going to make these log pressure and temperature so that I can draw on a single diagram solid, liquid, and vapor. And the way to think about volatiles are, one way to think about them, are materials with high vapor pressures. Okay. So we can look at the triple point for water, the triple point pressure, 611 pascals, 273 Kelvin. CO2, 10 to the 5 pascals and about 200 Kelvin. So these are modest numbers, but for rock, and I'll use a proxy, rock proxy number, it's order 1 pascals and 2,000 Kelvin. And so these pressures, the absolute magnitude of pressures at the triple points are larger, The absolute temperatures are smaller, so if we make the temperature hotter, the volatiles will go into the gas phase, and they will form this first atmosphere of the ocean. Now, there is a problem with thinking about the giant impact with this kind of cartoon. There are many problems with it, because it's a cartoon. But there is an assumption to drawing a sequence like this, and it's that the way I've drawn the planet basically assumes it's the same radius. And so the way this heating was applied was isobaric. I took the Earth as it is today, I heated it, and it melted, and gas came out. So it turns out that giant impacts, just so there's no confusion, giant impacts are not isobaric events. Okay. So this is wrong. So instead, I want you to think in your head, what happened during the moon forming event? And be time travelers now, back in time, 4.5 billion years ago. And imagine what the Earth looked like after the moon forming event. And make it cinematic. Close your eyes, conjure George Lucas, and make yourself a beautiful picture. Pretend you had box seats for viewing this impact. And just hold that in your head, and we'll revisit it again at the end. Okay, so to get everyone on the same page for what the real units are for giant impacts, I'll talk through the basic variables of the system, and then we'll go through what the Earth looked like afterwards. So the first one is time. The escape velocity on the proto-Earth was about 10 kilometers per second. So the impact event is actually very fast. So the time that we usually think about is the time it takes for the deformed body to gravitationally re-equilibrate. And so the time that is a good characteristic time is the gravitational re-equilibration freefall time, which is just 1 over root gravitational constant times the density. And if the density is order 1 gram per cc, 1,000 grams per kilogram, 1,000 kilograms per meter cubed, then this ends up being greater than about an hour. So the time that it takes for the two bodies to recover and form a quasi-spherical object again is several hours, several dynamical times. Okay. So in terms of length, the characteristic length scale is what determines sort of the edge of the Earth's zone in the aftermath of the moon-forming impact. And there's a planet, and at some distance, characteristic distance, moons can form. And this distance is called the Roche radius, or the Roche limit. And inside the Roche limit, there's a disk, or Saturn's rings. And so inside this limit, a moon will be tidally disrupted. The forces from tidal effects between the two bodies break them apart again. And so around Saturn, the rings look like a belt. They're very close, because this distance is about 3 times the planet's equatorial radius. So for Earth, that's 18,000 kilometers. And the moon must accrete beyond that distance. So the energy of the impact is all derived from the kinetic energy of the impactor. So this is, for the textbook version of this, this is a tenth of the Earth mass and approximately the mutual escape velocity. So this is about 10 kilometers per second. This is 3 times 10 to the 31 joules, which is basically a meaningless number. All of Earth's radioactive heat integrated over Earth's history is about 10 to the 30 joules. Okay. But I think it's more impressive to think of the power of the impact as the kinetic energy over the dynamical time. And that's 3 times 10, this is 26 joules per second. Does this look familiar to any astrophysicist in the room? I believe I got it right. solar luminosity. So a giant impact event in terms of the power liberated over the time scale of the event is like the energy coming out of the sun. It's a big deal. Okay, so the energy, another unit that's helpful is how much does it take to melt the Earth? And that's the mass of the Earth times the latent heat of melting. And that's something on the order of 10 to the 29 joules. So the kinetic energy of the impact is orders of magnitude larger than what it takes to melt the Earth. In fact, you more than melt the Earth, you must vaporize part of the Earth. And then the last units thing is the fact that there is rotation in this event. And so the radius of the impact can be thought of as basically the radius of the Earth, and cross product with the mass of the impactor times the velocity of the impactor gives us the magnitude of angular momentum. So our Earth times a tenth of the Earth mass times v escape, miraculously, is today's present day angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system today. And this was an amazing feature of the original proposal for the moon-forming giant impact, that a Mars mass body, which was a standard protoplanet that falls out of growing the planets in a disk, that this size body striking a proto-Earth would just happen to match. So this was a wonderful byproduct of the original impact model to actually set the conditions that would give us the length of day. Okay. So the angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system is the spin of the Earth, the orbit of the Moon, and the spin of the Moon combined. If you run the movie back in time so that the Moon comes closer to the Earth and sits at the Roche limit, to conserve angular momentum, which is one of those absolute conservation laws of physics, the Earth had a period of 5 hours. So this molten vaporized body is spinning much faster than it does today. Now, it does not take very much to make this number bigger. It's actually more common to have a higher angular momentum outcome from a giant impact. And the limit for an Earth-like body, 30% iron, 70% rock, is about 3 times the present-day angular momentum. Beyond that, the equator keeps flying off. You just have rotation speeds that are so fast that you can't shove any more mass in without changing the material. So somewhere between 0 and 3, present-day Earth angular momenta is the limit of our system. There, you know everything about giant impacts. You can go home and tell your family, I understand giant impacts, you have all the numbers, you have all the units, basically done. All right, so let's talk about what the Earth really did and why this isobaric assumption is so bad. So I will keep this part up at the top for reference and start everyone. All right, so when this body slams into the proto-Earth, that slows it down. So all of the energy, the kinetic energy being carried by this impactor, some portion of it now has to go somewhere else. And so imagine a parcel of material on the protoplanet. The impact drives a shock into the body, so that this is the original material in the, so this is the target. And behind the shock wave, the pressure goes up, the internal energy goes up, there's a new material velocity, entropy goes up, temperature goes up, everything goes up. Okay. And this shock wave basically conserves energy, mass and momentum to solve the problem of what are the conditions in the two bodies when the impact occurs. And the outcome is a material property. So which is difficult to predict, especially for geologic materials. So this is the thing that my day job is to make measurements of shock waves in geologic materials to derive this line called a shock Hugonio, where for a rock at a given initial condition, at initial pressure and volume, that there is a locus of shock states that we call, the jargon is called the shock Hugonio. And this line depends on the material. If it's an ideal gas, it's a very easy line to derive and draw, but for everything else, measurements are required or some sophisticated calculations. And so drawn linearly, so the shock comes along and takes this material and instantly raises the pressure. This is the locus of shock state, so everywhere in the body is raised to a different shock pressure depending on where it's located. And the total energy that's deposited is the area underneath that line. And a little while later, sound waves traveling around the body release that shock state so that the release isentrope that decompresses ideally looks something like this. And because the energy was enough to vaporize the rock, a linear scale does not show you what happens next. So I'll translate to log volume, log pressure, so that you can see the boundary between liquid and vapor. And liquid is a narrow little field, so just next to it is solid. And this shock Hugonio, starting in the solid, goes up. And these release curves come down, intersect this vapor dome, and at the pressure that this intersection occurs, begins to boil and expand. And this is log volume. So the expansion of a rock upon shock and decompression can be 5-7 orders of magnitude. So the body that we have struck now needs to take up a heck of a lot more space. It will become physically much larger. Now, these blue curves are something you can measure in the lab. They're hard. And to save ourselves a lot of trouble, because they're hard to draw, we like to use another thermodynamic state variable called entropy. This is a specific entropy. I'll draw the phase diagram, and then you'll know why we like it so much better. Okay. So in this phase diagram is the same as this phase diagram above it. And this, the field for solids occurs at low entropy, low thermal states. This is the enthalpy of melting to the liquid field, and then enthalpy of vaporization to vapor. This is the critical point, and this line is the triple point. And so what you can't see on the PT diagram is how much energy do you have to put in order to melt or vaporize. But on an entropy diagram, we can easily determine how much melt and how much vapor exists in each parcel of material. And so on this space, a Hugonio starting in the solid shocks up, melts, and then transitions into supercritical fluid. And so for every given pressure on the Hugonio, the release path is now a straight line down. And then using the lever rule for the entropy of the liquid and the entropy of vapor, I can calculate the mass fraction that's vaporized. So this entropy is a mixture of liquid and vapor that are defined by these endpoints. If I released to lower pressures, it'd be a mixture of solid and vapor defined by the endpoint. So think droplets suspended in gas, perfectly coupled. It turns out that in a giant impact, the shock pressures are sufficiently high, on the order of hundreds of gigapascals, that the entropies attained reach the vapor side of this diagram, so that in the outer parts of the structure, it's mostly vapor. And it's trivial to get onto that side of the phase diagram in a giant impact.
Is this system a thermal equilibrium?
This is an equilibrium phase diagram. It is the same as the other diagram, just different units. Are the parcels. The parcels are locally in thermodynamic equilibrium. Yeah, so imagine a rock. Here comes a Mars-sized object that hits us. To first order, you could model it as starting in this state, shocking to this state, and then isentropically or adiabatically decompressing. And one actually has to travel very far down in pressure before other stuff happens. And the reason for that is that this is all combined with changes in velocity that are so large that the inertia of the mass prevents any other phase separation or interaction until you're at very low pressures. So yeah, we simplify to an equilibrium diagram with good reason. Any other questions?
What's the compression ratio? So on the Hugonio, there's always a maximum.
So for, yeah, ideal gases is something like 3 or something, right? But let's see. Yeah, not that different. 3 times the density, 2 to 3 times the density up here. It's really the volume expansion that leads to the big change in densities when you go to low expansion states. Yeah.
What's the composition?
So I called it rock up there. Earth, rock. So if I wanted to write down a single mineral structure for the Earth's mantle, it would be this, magnesium, silicon, and oxygens. And so it vaporizes, but not congruently. And so on this side, there's SiOs and MgOs and Os on the vapor. But I'm drawing a single component phase diagram just to simplify the process. The water,
The
water is dissolved into the rock in these high temperature post-impact states. So I was just about to get to
Is that the opposite of what you expect? It is the opposite.
It's exactly the opposite. You are right. So let me give you some more numbers. I will answer this question momentarily. Are there any other questions about this diagram before I start relating physical space and composition to this type of diagram?
So this process you draw is from the impact itself.
It's during the impact. The shock wave travels across the whole Earth in the first half hour. Oh yes, everything is obliterated. Yeah. Okay. So instead of the same radius magma planet picture, the impact creates a rotating, very large volume object. And so you should think of a bow tie in cross section that's axisymmetric. So rotating. And in the middle, there's an iron core. And the mantle is hot material. And I'll draw the post-impact structure here. So after the giant impact, I could take the thermal states of all of the rock and plot them on the same diagram. And so what you'll remember is that this is deeper, and this is towards the surface, whatever that surface is. And the inner parts of the body are just melted. And then there's a very strong thermal gradient to the outer parts of the body, which then intersect the vapor side of the vapor dome. And so in here, what you should think of is that the body that struck the Earth generated a shock wave, but the amplitude of the wave varied quite strongly across the proto-Earth, so that near the impact site, I generated material with very high entropy, basically all vapor. But on the opposite, the antipodes of both bodies, the shock pressure was much lower, the increase in entropy was much smaller, and so portions of the body just barely melted or near the liquidus of rock. And in the gravitational re-equilibration that took several hours, the dense, colder portions of rock sunk, and the hot vapor rose, so that at the end, there's a thermally stratified with the high entropy gas on top, the low entropy liquid on bottom. So in the inner part here, there is a low entropy liquid and a transition to a supercritical fluid, and in the outer parts is vapor and droplets. And the extent of this can be several times, let's see, in some of my calculations, the Roche radius could be right here. Okay, so it's huge. And in terms of all the bound mass, the Roche radius is 18,000 kilometers. The bound mass can go out to 160,000 kilometers or so, right after the event, in the 24-hour, 48-hour time frame. So in the inner part, a low entropy liquid, a transition to a supercritical fluid. Supercritical fluid just means the pressures and the temperatures are above this critical point. Supercritical fluid, and then here is vapor plus droplets. And the reason why there are droplets is because there's a photic surface on this body that becomes complicated at the edges, which is the optically thick layer that's radiating, and the temperature of radiation is about 2,000 Kelvin, and maybe 10 to the minus 5 bar. I switched units, Pascal, 1 Pascal. Okay. So that body would fit in just the very inner part of this whole structure. Okay. And so because this structure, if you think of the cylindrical radius, Rxy, the angular velocity versus the cylindrical radius for the textbook Mars-size impact case, there's an inner portion that rotates altogether. That would be the planet itself. And then there's a disk of material that rotates on Keplerian velocities. So this is r goes, omega goes as r to the minus 2/3. Okay. And this boundary is the boundary between the planet and the disk. And in many papers, they'll use today's Earth radius, but it turns out that when you take into the account that the Earth is puffy, because it's so hot, the Earth can be twice its radius. And remember, the Roche limit is only 3 times the present-day radius, which means there's a very small amount of space that is this disk around the Earth out to where the Moon is forming. Now, I mentioned that angular momentum is something that is can be much higher in a giant impact. And when that is the case, Rxy, this is the 5-hour day that I told you about. When the angular momentum is larger, what happens is the equatorial radius becomes larger because the spinning fluid is more oblate, and now the equatorial radius is larger than the polar radius, and so the radial extent of the planet is larger. So let's say this is a 2.5-hour day. It intersects the equator of the body intersects Keplerian orbital velocities, and there is a seamless transition into a disk-like region. And so this is this object is not a planet. And the reason we actually gave it a name. So this is something, a synestia is a body that exceeds what the co-rotation limit. So co-rotation is this inner part. It turns out that for a given system, there's a maximum amount of mass and angular momentum that you can put into the inner part of into a spinning body. And if you exceed a curve in angular momentum and mass and energy, the body will intersect Keplerian velocities and a portion of the mass will become a disk. So you can think of a planet like the Earth as some set of parameters where all of those parameters can be put into a single object that spins with the same period. And there is a contour in multidimensional space where if you exceed that contour, the mass cannot be put into a body that spins all at the same rate, and instead it must form a disk-like zone around it. And that is a different planetary object, and so we gave it its own name, synestia. And so it turns out that giant impacts make synestias very easily. Once you get above about 1.5 times the present-day angular momenta, synestias are the common outcome. And so then stuff happens, and the moon would form within this big gas structure. Okay. Now let's talk about what's happening to the Earth. So on this phase diagram, we now want to make our planet that looks like this. If we call this the beginning of the Earth, the beginning of the Hadean, when we finally have a steam atmosphere over a magma ocean, we have a lot of work to do to get from this state back down to this state, and a lot of energy to remove. Yes? So I may not have sketched it exactly to scale, but if this is three, so I've exaggerated the core. Let's make the core a little smaller, and then the present day Earth might be this, three times, yeah. So a good deal smaller.
The spinning velocity, does it depend on the impact angle? How well the spinning is?
So when you reach this condition, depends on the energy of the event, because it depends on how hot that inner state is. And so if you think of the entropy of the outer layer, so the entropy of the outer layer, it scales with log times the specific energy of the impact. So we basically defined a specific energy for the event. And for most, and it looks like this. So the outer part is linearly larger in entropy compared to log the specific energy. And so the outer parts exceed the critical points for most giant impacts. Okay? So now it has to cool. And the energy that has to be liberated to go from this state to that state is 10 to the 31 or 10 to the 32 joules. And you may ask, why is it larger than the energy we started with? It's because when you take two planets and look at their potential energies, gravitational potential energies, and you combine them into one planet, the gravitational potential energy is a more negative number. So we have to release heat. And the magnitude of heat released is comparable to the energy of the impact itself. And so you can't neglect gravitational potential energy, and we have to radiate away 10 to the 31 to 10 to the 32 joules. Okay, and we have a lot of radiating power at the beginning, and it doesn't slow down until water becomes our major opacity in the upper atmosphere. So the path to cooling is to rain magma. Yes, you heard that right, magma rain. So at the photosphere, a little parcel of rock vapor radiates away. And on this phase diagram, the parcel of rock vapor radiates away the latent heat of vaporization and becomes a liquid droplet. The liquid droplet is not stable and will fall in. And as it falls in, It's hotter, higher pressure, and so it follows the phase boundary because it's boiling as it falls in. And depending on its size, it will either evaporate again, or it may make it all the way down to the middle and try to add mass to the growing moon, or it may spiral its way in and be dragged onto the planet. So the way that cooling works in synestia, in any post-impact state, is for the vapor to condense and rain down inwards, and that cools the overall thermal profile, raindrop by raindrop. At the beginning, the rain is so vigorous, it's a sort of a factor of 10 worse than Hurricane Harvey for anyone from Hurricane Harvey dumped, 100 inches in 2 days or something, right? So we're raining at 10 times faster than that in the photosphere. It's torrential rain. Okay, so torrential rain leads to interesting, a rapid evolution of the phase boundary. And this initial profile moves to the left so that at a later time, the boundary, the layer that's raining becomes thicker, and the system contracts as vapor is converted into liquid. And eventually, all of the outer regions will be on the liquid vapor boundary as rainfall has separated some of that hot vapor mass. Okay. The amount of material in this hot layer to begin with is 10 to 40% of the planet. So it can be that half of the rock, all of the rock, is initially at entropies above the critical point. So it's a lot of mass to cool. And when the planet is this red line, it did not intersect the liquid vapor, the liquid curve. And in this state of a liquid to supercritical fluid to vapor, there is no magma ocean surface. And immediately after every giant impact, all the different flavors that are out there, there's no surface to float a boat on. There's no surface. The Earth temporarily looks a lot more like Jupiter than any rocky body that we see today. Okay. And so the first liquid boundary that develops occurs when magma rain has removed mass from the vaporized outer system and shrunk the body so that there's now only vapor that lies on the vapor curve, and the very first surface is at the critical point, just as the body cools below the critical point. So where's the critical point? This is something we're trying to measure in the lab. It's 1 to 10 kilobars and 5,000 to 6,000 Kelvin. So the very first surface of the Earth were under these conditions. I would call that Hadean, right? quite hot and inhospitable. Okay. So where are our volatiles? Where's all the water, CO2, nitrogen, noble gases, etc.? Immediately after the impact in this high temperature state where it's several thousand degrees, it is a silicate fluid with all of the volatiles dissolved into the fluid. It's a high temperature silicate solution, and all of the volatiles that the Earth retained through the event, which is most of them, are dissolved into this rock vapor. And instead of thinking of the atmosphere outgassing from a molten Earth, you should think of this rock vapor solution having magma raining out of it and water and steam being left behind. So how many of you had that as the movie in your head at the beginning? It's crazy. But that's the thermodynamic path. And so as rain occurs, this whole structure shrinks. And the first surface is at kilobars, thousands of times the Earth's surface pressure. It's a combination of rock vapor and volatiles that were present in the outer part of the structure. So one of the puzzles of the Earth, in terms of the geochemistry that we see, is that the lower mantle retains scraps of gases like helium and neon from before the giant impact that actually look like they have signatures of the solar nebula. And the moon-forming event was long after the solar nebula. And so one thing you should notice about all of these lines that I've drawn is that they're all stably stratified. Remember, the top is down, deeper is there. So if there were scraps of a certain gas trapped in the lower mantle, they are not convectively mixing up to the surface because of this thermal stratification. So convection can occur in the lowermost layer. All sorts of interesting stuff is happening at the top. But there's not, it is not favorable thermally for a parcel of material in the deepest portions to transport all the way up to the photosphere and back down. Yes?
Can you give us a sense for the time scale, the thermal time of this?
Of cooling. So to go from the beginning, the event, to making the magma ocean surface, probably 1,000 to 1,000s of years. So short on a geologic timescale, but the moon forms presumably in much less time, tens to hundreds of years. So while the moon may be formed before the Earth has its first liquid surface, in some models, yeah. And then the portion of the planet that actually has water and CO2 bubbles are the portion of the planet that has the magma rain that are at pressures that are below the critical point. And that's a small fraction of the total mass. It's only a single weight percent of the Earth that is undergoing this phase separation. So imagine the whole ocean, plus another ocean in the mantle, dissolved into this hot silicate vapor. Its concentration would be something like 1,000 ppm. Only the very uppermost layers are degassed to go into what will be the brand new atmosphere. Yeah. The moon has scraps, but it formed at high temperatures and modest pressures. And so the moon forms here within the structure near the boiling point of silica. And you can dissolve a tiny amount of OH into it. If you're thinking, which volatiles are you thinking of? Potassium or
water?
A little bit of water could be dissolved. So comparable to a little bit can be dissolved. We didn't actually calculate how much, but other people have tried. A little bit can be dissolved. It's not a paradox that the moon has a little bit of water. Okay, so first magma ocean forms, and then silicate rain keeps occurring. And silicate rain keeps occurring until there's no more rock to rain out. And the only thing left behind is a steam and other volatile atmosphere. And so at this point, where the surface is at about 100 bars, where the top of the magma ocean separates from the rock vapor diagram is at about 4,000 Kelvin at about 100 bars. And so at the point where there's no more rock vapor, the surface of the magma ocean is still superheated compared to the bottom of the mantle. So even at this point, the whole mantle can't convect together. Okay. So another way to think And there are more problems than just that. The whole mantle cannot convect together. I mentioned very fast rotations, 2.5 hours. At the point that 2.5-hour magma ocean planet has an equatorial radius that's about 2 times the polar radius. Okay, so it's an extremely oblate body. And based on the Rossby number, it's about 0.01 at this point. There may be columnar convection, which is what we think is happening inside Jupiter. And funny stuff at the poles. And so we cannot think of the whole mantle freely convecting. And it's still thermally stratified when it first gets its atmosphere. First time there's a volatile atmosphere. And so then the surface of the planet needs to cool down to about whatever the lower mantle is. But the lower mantle is near the liquidist. So starting at 4,000 Kelvin, it probably needs to reach about 2,500. And at that point, the lower mantle starts to freeze. So there's probably a really narrow window in time when there is a possibility of a single adiabat in the magma ocean before the lower mantle begins to freeze. Most of the time, going from the post-impact structure to cooling the planet, the whole thing is stably stratified. Okay, question.
How much time has elapsed by the time we get to this?
So to get down to this point was about 1,000, 2,000 of years, and then maybe several hundreds of years to cool the magma ocean, depending on the radiative temperature, which is now hundreds of Kelvin instead of, because it's water vapor, instead of 2,000 Kelvin. So there's time, it's just that it's not a single adiabat for the magma. And then with columnar convection, the efficiency to get to the very surface is harder to remove gases from the deep mantle. So last point of and then there'll be hopefully questions. All right, the last point is when the planet is rotating this quickly, there is a very strong centrifugal force. Okay. So the centrifugal force is the fictitious force that feels like an outward force. It reduces the effective gravitational acceleration. Okay. So if the planet is spinning faster, the core mantle boundary pressure is lower. And it can be a lot lower. And at 2.5 hours, the pressure at the core mantle boundary could be as low as 60 to 80 GPa. Today, for the other people in the room, it's about 137 GPa. So it could be half. Okay. The geoscientists in the room really care about this. And I'll explain why they really care about this. They really care because so this is the core mantle boundary today, 137 GPa. And this is the liquidus. This is where the rock mixture begins to freeze. For normal materials with the slope of the phase diagram, where at higher pressures, it's higher temperatures to melt, most materials would freeze from the bottom up. Ices are a very common exception where it floats, but most materials would freeze from the bottom up. It turns out that liquids are very complicated things, and people like Lars Stixrud in the audience have calculated the adiabats in the magma. So this is a magma adiabat. This is the adiabat, the simplification of what a fully convective magma ocean would look like. And as it cools, intersects solidification somewhere in the mantle, let's say between 60 to 80 GPa or so. And there are thoughts that some of the strange things we see at the bottom of the mantle may be related to a basal magma ocean, where our planet began to freeze at some mid-mantle layer and trapped some of the magma at the very bottom near the core mantle boundary. But if we were spinning quickly and the core mantle boundary pressures were reduced, then the mantle may freeze from the bottom up. And so this is an important aspect for the geochemical signatures we see in the bottom of the mantle today. Of course, the magnitude of the pressure decrease depends on the details of the angular momenta. And so you can get everything in between. And likely it's something in between. It's still just annoyingly close to this intersection of the magma ocean with the solidification curve. Okay, so stepping back, I wish I could draw a very simple cartoon to replace the one above. But instead, you're going to have to think of a big donut, which is what the news media called the synestia. It's a biconcave disk, so it looks like a red blood cell, or just think of a big donut or a bow tie cross section. It's a huge structure. It's radiating at 2,000 degrees, so it looks like a red dwarf star. And there's magma rain, cooling it down, and the magma rains out and leaves behind the volatile atmosphere, forming the first surface of the Earth after a giant impact. Most of the process of cooling occurs under stratified conditions to limit global mixing. Rotation effects are huge, may be important depending on how we actually made the moon. And so hopefully you've got a more interesting movie in your head now about making the Earth.
So did I understand you to say that the moon is just the result of this condensing magma and it doesn't start with some core?
So in most models of giant impacts, a portion of the system did not fully vaporize, and there can be liquid blobs in orbit that form what we call the seed for the moon. It can be a small mass fraction of the final moon, it could be a bigger, it depends sensitively on the impact itself. So there is a lunar seed, but the moon accretes as a boiling liquid object, so it itself is well mixed.
Same question, I think.
Yes, so just in, because giant impacts have so much energy and spin to them, when we just tried to estimate what would happen, most rocky planets would be a synestia, would go through these, most rocky planets have these high temperature events. They don't have moons. So moons are, the inner solar system has a lot of dynamical influences on each other. So Mercury's interactions with the sun, if it had a moon, it would have lost a moon. The same with Venus. Venus could have lost a moon, or the moon could have struck the body. And so we don't have enough planets for good statistics about moons. Mars's moons, there are models of forming them with a more modest but still giant impact. Moons are a byproduct of giant impacts, but most of them are going to be small, and the inner ones in our solar system would be lost. We had an interesting event that led to our large mass moon. Our moon is unusually big, yes.
So, I don't know much about your initial conditions. I don't know how long ago that happened.
For
I'm also drawing it as two spheres.
Yeah.
I don't know their temperature.
Yeah.
And if there are two massive objects coming towards each other, would they really maintain a spherical shape? And does that, any of that matter?
So, towards the end of planet formation, the time between giant impacts is long enough that we do expect the planets to recondense. And so there are rocky or partially molten bodies that are colliding. So they start off spherical or oblate spheroids because they're all spinning. As they approach, the approach takes enough time that they can be tidally deformed slightly beforehand. In terms of what I've said just now, there's not a significant perturbation to any of that. In terms of tracking scraps of ocean and atmosphere around the bodies as they're approaching, then it can be important that they are tidally deformed, but no one has actually worked out the math for that. The moon forming impact, well, 4.5 billion years ago. So, and in terms of the time zero of the solar system, when the first rocks formed within the solar system, some 50 to 100 million years after time zero. Yeah.
What is the reason for the
biconcave disk? Biconcave, all disks are flared with distance from the central mass because the vertical component of gravity decreases with cylindrical radius. So that's why everything looks like a disk. Yeah.
Are there any complications with the fact that the Earth is, the rocky part of the Earth is not only MgSiO3?
There are lots of chemical difficulties with modeling this phase separation process. And if you would like to work on it, I'd be happy for more collaborators, because this is hard. And it leads to predicting the chemistry of the moon, how much volatiles are in the moon. It leads to predictions of the first atmosphere. Those are all important parts of working out the multi-component chemistry. To first order, the single component phase diagram is fine. Yeah.
So would this spinning pressure reduction effect have a latitudinal dependence? And
yes.
Oh,
I didn't do the end. Oh, I forgot. So yes, so the Earth, if this happened, we were spinning and we were at lower pressures, the Earth may freeze at low pressures. And then the tidal evolution of the moon, the last step about the angular momentum, is that you have to get to today, this conservation of angular momentum problem. And so something during the tidal evolution of the moon has to transfer angular momentum from the Earth-Moon system to the Earth-Sun system. And that would decrease the rotation rate and increase the pressure of the Earth. So the tidal evolution of the moon happens in the first 1 million to 10 million years. And so, of course, we're keenly interested in thinking about any evidence of this change in the early Earth. And what we're writing a paper now that discusses it and makes some suggestions about pressure-induced melting at the bottom of the mantle. Yes. So rather than a basal magma ocean, pressure-induced melting during lunar tidal evolution, which is a different chemical path for all of you guys. So, yeah. So,
and also what kind of prediction, this is a one-time experiment, right? So,
there were several giant impacts. We can't just, we can't reproduce it in the lab. We can,
so,
right.
For example, the, you know, mantle cross-thickness, so what features can we observe today that tell us about different
theories? So, what is controversial? And what is not? There's no other working model other than a giant impact for making the moon. There are variations of the giant impact that are look quite different from each other. So what's controversial is how fast was the Earth spinning at the after the event. That's not known and being debated and worked out now. We made predictions for the chemistry of the moon based on a high energy, high spin event that do better than other calculations, but it's hard to calculate, so it's really hard to test. So we have to fold in chemistry, because the real tests will be in the chemical tracers that can survive 4.5 billion years. All of the surface deformation, things like that, those are all long gone. But what we can do is speak to perhaps what was preserved in the lowermost mantle and the conditions for core formation. Bethany Chittister's poster later this week will have that aspect of what was the pressure in the Earth, and that's a coarser but still important factor for trying to deconvolve the different ideas. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Fun? I don't know what quantum thermodynamics is, but.